You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, August 1st, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. In the age of austerity, today on the show, folks, this.
You have been quoted coming out of your caucus as calling this agreement a sugar-coated Satan sandwich. Was that indeed your quote? Is that how you feel about this deal?
It's a very accurate quote. What I'm saying is that if you lift the bomb, what you see is antithetical to everything the great religions of the world teach, which is take care of the poor, take care of the aged. And when you look at the phone calls I've gotten, they're 7-1 in favor of a balanced deal and also preserving Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And I'm concerned about this because we don't know the details. And until we see the details, we're going to be extremely non-committed. But on the surface, it looks like a Satan sandwich.
Yes, we know the details now, folks. And it is indeed a Satan sandwich, and not Satan sandwich for you people who enjoy that vegetarian delight. A Satan sandwich. Today on the program, I bite into it. I take a huge bite, and I try and keep my gag reflex from spewing it all over my computer, in which case we may have some broadcast problems. We're already having a problem with our Sammy Cam because I puked on the Satan sandwich. In fact, in just a minute or two, I will be talking to Ezra Klein of the Washington Post on this Satan sandwich. But let's start. I want to just start with this one piece so we can set the table here in the New York Times. So we will be able to discuss the implications of this deal in the proper context. New York Times reports last week brought the disconcerting news that the economy grew no faster than the population during the first 6 months of the year, in part because of spending cuts by state and local governments. Now the federal government is cutting too. Unemployment will be higher than it would have been otherwise, said dirty fucking hippie. No, wait, I'm sorry. That wasn't a dirty hippie. That was Mohammed El Arian, the chief executive of PIMCO. Not a classic hippie, he said this Sunday on ABC. Growth will be lower than it would be otherwise, and inequality would be worse than it would be otherwise. We have a very weak economy, so withdrawing more spending at this stage will make it even weaker. This is not going to help the economy. This is going to hurt the economy. Put aside every other implication of what it means politically, what it means rhetorically, everything that has gone on here. We've capitulated to hostage takers. Put all that aside. This deal is going to hurt the economy and probably even increase the deficit long term. We will get to that. There's broad agreement the United States needs to pay down its debts, but most economists say the government would have waited a year or more for the economy to strengthen. May take a little bit more. The Republican authors of the debt ceiling say that cutting the size of government will increase economic growth down the road because federal borrowing soaks up money otherwise available to private businesses. Yet we are at the lowest interest rates possible that we could probably ever possibly see. So the idea that the federal government is soaking up all this money is ludicrous. Profits are at an all-time high, corporate profits. Stock market is up. From an accounting point of view, it seems obvious you would reduce GDP if you cut government spending, said Randall Krosner, economics professor at the University of Chicago and a former Fed governor appointed by Bush. But the key is really the impact on consumption and investment. If you reduce government spending, and if people think that reduces uncertainty about the tax burden down the line, they may be more comfortable with spending. Yes, that's why 50% of the country is not spending any money, because they're focused on potential taxation in the future. What? It may be because they don't have any cash or because they don't have a job. No, in fact, it's the idea that someday in the future we may get taxed more, so I'm not going to spend now.
Come with me and you'll be
that is
in a world of pure
ridiculous.
Imagination.
So with that said, let's take a break. We will talk to Ezra Klein about the outlines of this deal in just a moment. We are back on the Majority Report. Sam Cedar on the phone. Washington Post. Ezra Klein. Ezra, thanks for joining us.
How are you?
I'm doing okay. It was quite a weekend. combination of my daughter breaking her wrist, but the upside is I found a new great apple, and then all of this huge debt deal.
Well, I'm sorry to hear about your daughter.
Yes, thank you. I appreciate that. The apple is actually great. It's called the Pristine. I'm trying to look on the happy things.
Okay.
It's a mid-season apple, and it's delicious. If you like those sour candy apples, that's what this is. That's where they got that flavor from. In the meantime, the age of austerity, right? Well, tell us what's the deal here?
The deal here is that nobody has to make any major sacrifice quite yet. The way I'm thinking about this is they've found the lowest common denominator. There are no taxes. That much in spending cuts. It's not the $4 trillion of deficit reduction from the Obama-Boehner talks. It isn't the $3 trillion from the Biden-Cantor talks. It's $900 billion, and about half of that is defense or security-related spending. So I don't think you should be chopping necessarily another $500 billion or so out of non-defense discretionary spending, the sort of domestic programs like education and transportation and infrastructure. But what we've actually got in here isn't that big over 10 years. It doesn't start for a couple years either. Then there's stage two, this big sort of congressional super committee, as it's called, that's going to recommend $1.5 trillion or more in deficit reduction. And if they don't come to an agreement that passes Congress and gets signed into law by the president, there'll be some trigger that makes massive cuts in defense and domestic spending for over 10 years. Now, the big question is what that committee comes up with and whether or not Congress can pass it. And if it doesn't pass it, whether or not the trigger actually happens. And I think on all those, you know, the jury is really out.
Right. We have no idea. So short term, we're not talking about a tremendous amount of cuts automatic anyways over the next year. Just about, what is it, like something like 0.01% of GDP?
Very small. Although the one caveat to that, because it's not showing up in here because it's not in CBO, when we did the 2010 tax deal, we extended about $60 billion in expanded unemployment benefits and about $120 to $150, depending on which measure you use, in payroll tax cuts. So that's obviously benefits for the jobless and then the working class. Now, those were both expected to expire at the end of 2010, at the end of 2011, though a lot of people thought they'd be extended after that too. Now, this deal doesn't extend either one. that doesn't count as a cut in spending from what the Congressional Budget Office expected. But in terms of the real support we're providing to the economy, that's very significant. I mean, that's losing about $150 billion of economic support that's going directly to the people who need it most. And those were both supposed to be extended if we got that sort of $4 trillion big deal. But in the current deal, neither of them are extended at all.
So do you have a sense as to I mean, if you include that, I mean, what are we looking at in terms of job losses because of this? Because I know that back during the tax deal, there were some numbers thrown around, at least as a baseline, as to what we might be losing. But this is going to cost at least tens of thousands of jobs, right? I mean, we're not talking about a huge amount of money, but when you take that type of money out of the economy at a time like this, it costs jobs.
I think the sort of particularly payroll and unemployment benefits, that will be a very significant hit to jobs. I'm not the guy who did those numbers, so I don't want to sort of ballpark them because I don't remember sort of how the models worked. But, you know, you're looking at a very weak economy. A week ago we got these numbers from the Bureau of Economic Accounts, for the new GDP numbers, and we found out the economy has been much weaker over the past 3 years than we thought, and it's slowing now, the recovery. What did we grow at? Something like 0.4% last quarter. This is a real bad economy, and one problem isn't just sort of the direct amount of money we're taking out, but when we're not sort of supporting the recovery and then you have all this risk everywhere else, you do have this confidence problem where businesses look around and all they see is risk. All they see is reasons that people are not going to buy their products next year, reasons that people are not going to have money to spend, and so reasons for them not to build a new factory, not to invest in a new line of products. It's very hard to see right now in this economy, in the global economy, where recovery comes from, and we've made it decision in this country, and it's not a wise decision, that we are going to move to austerity instead of doing what most economists would recommend, which is pairing a lot of long-term deficit reduction beginning in something like 2013, 2014, 2015, but also short-term economic support and significantly more economic support than we're providing now. Instead, we're doing not that much long-term deficit reduction and no short-term support. I mean, we've really hit the worst of both worlds.
So and now, just for the sake of my audience here, when we talk about this this first $900 billion, the $1 trillion, $350 billion, my understanding is, comes out of defense related stuff, security related stuff. The rest comes from discretionary. What is domestic discretionary? What are those type of things?
So let me say two things on this. One, it's a little bit more than $350. So defense gets a $350 hit. Then there's this larger pool of spending called security spending. That includes the State Department, it includes veterans benefits, it includes foreign aid, it includes a couple other things like that. That gets also some hits. So I think it's sort of going to be a little bit higher than $350. But you're right that what we traditionally think of as defense is $350. Now, you bring up domestic discretionary. This is one of the most frustrating parts of the debate to me. If politicians actually had to specify what they were cutting in domestic discretionary, this debate would be 100% different. So here are the top three items in domestic discretionary: education, transportation, and housing assistance. And if you just sort of go on in domestic discretionary, you see income supports for the blind and the deaf, you see infrastructure investment, you see medical research, health services. I mean, everything that is in the win the future pot, all that money we're investing in the country, that's all domestic discretionary. That is the most of it is investment. And then the next biggest part is income support.
Food.
And then the next biggest part is government operations like the FBI, the courts, things like that. You know, and because nobody knows what it is, they know what a Medicare cut is or a Social Security cut is, but because nobody knows what this stuff is offhand, it's easy to cut, and it shouldn't be, because it's actually a place where there is not that much waste in the government compared to, say, in the tax code, compared, frankly, even into Medicare or Medicaid, although Medicaid is actually pretty lean, but and particularly, by the way, compared to the defense sector. So when politicians sort of hide behind that discretionary spending cuts, you know, it sort of makes me a little sick to my stomach, because what they're doing, and they may not even know it, is they're basically putting one over on us. They are taking things that would be very, very tough to cut if people knew what it was, and by not telling people what they're actually cutting, they're getting away with it.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty stunning, actually, because, you know, I read a dozen, maybe more stories on this morning, and there's not a single one that actually breaks out what discretionary actually means.
But if you've been reading my blog on Friday,
well,
Sam.
Of course, I do read the blog on Friday. I read it every day.
I have graphs and everything.
But I think, you know, across the board, it's really stunning in that respect. Okay, so then we move to this super committee. there are some very important aspects to this in terms of who ends up on there. And this element of the anti-tax sort of forces in the Republican Party and the hawkish forces in the Republican Party will sort theoretically will be at odds with each other, correct?
Absolutely. So the theory of a trigger is that you need something that is devastating enough that both parties are going to come and be willing to make sacrifices. Now, what you'd really want on the trigger are taxes, because that's what Republicans really hate and fear, and that's actually the sacrifice ultimately they need to make for us to get a real deficit deal. But they weren't willing to accept that, and the Democrats weren't willing to let the debt ceiling cave in. So instead, we went to a very, very, very deep trigger on defense spending. And let me just stop for a moment on the trigger to show how deep it is. What the trigger does is it creates what's called a firewall. And it's going to cut $1.2 trillion over 10 years if it goes off. And it does a sort of an equal match, $1 from defense spending for every dollar from domestic spending. Now, it exempts Social Security, Medicaid, and a couple other programs for the poor. So basically what it's doing is it is cutting defense spending as if defense spending made up more than half of our budget. It's nowhere close to that. I mean, nowhere near it. But the cuts to the Pentagon will be much, 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 much deeper than the cuts to anything else in the government. And so the theory is that Republicans, you know, who get obviously, and so do Democrats, by the way, get a lot of money from defense contractors and also, you know, care a lot about military spending, will not be willing to let that trigger go off. So either they're going to come to a deal or they're going to sort of find some way to evade the trigger. Now, maybe that's not true. Maybe Republicans who have been willing to let some pretty horrible things happen, like the debt ceiling, will be willing to let that trigger go off rather than raise taxes or do other things that Democrats would consider congenial. But so the theory right now is that this trigger is so deep on the defense spending side, it's so sort of abnormally deep on the defense spending side that the GOP will not let it go off, even though taxes are not included in it.
Now, the weird thing is that for someone who, like myself, who and perhaps at least part of this audience, I may not want that trigger to go off, because if it's not the trigger, what we're possibly looking at is that in the event that they do, preclude the trigger, things that could be in that package could be cuts to Social Security, cuts to Medicare, cuts to Medicaid, could be more discretionary spending. I mean, I guess presumably in the trigger, half of it, a little more than half of it would be discretionary at that point. And I guess theoretically, it could also be tax increases. But
you know, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Is that accurate, though?
I think it is. You know, you're getting something I want to write later today, which is that, you know, the original fear on the trigger was that it was a sort of heads Republicans win, tails Democrats lose trigger, where it's just across-the-board spending cuts, and why do Republicans care? Now, I don't think Republicans are going to go for tax increases at all in an election year, so I think it's very unlikely there's going to be a balanced deal coming out of this commission. And so I think you're now getting to this interesting question. This trigger exempts Social Security. It exempts Medicaid. And it just savages the Defense Department. Now, what is it that we think is going to be better in this deal for liberals than the trigger?
Right.
Now, I think you can actually offer some answers to that. Number one, the trigger is not backloaded. So you could get a deal and the cuts would be sort of in the back half of sort of, you know, 2020 or whatever, 2017, when the economy is more secure. Now, that would probably be better for the recovery. Now, another thing like that is blunt across-the-board cuts are going to hurt some real programs you don't want to hurt while being able to target them. You can go after things that are, frankly, you really should be going after, you know, deep reforms we should be making to Medicare or even, frankly, you know, to Social Security. There are things you might want to do there. So, you know, in a way, if you could get a good deal, that would obviously be better than the trigger, but that presupposes this question. If you can get a good or moderate or even, frankly, somewhat sensible deal, and I wouldn't put the odds of that at 100%. So, I mean, it is an interesting question you pose that, you know, maybe they've made a trigger now that for Democrats, it would be preferable to see it go off than to agree to anything Republicans are going to be willing to agree to. And I'll just make one final point on this, which is that the Bush tax cuts are still on the table to expire in 2012. So that creates a tax trigger at the end of 2012 that if Republicans let that go off, if they don't come to some accommodation with the administration over extending some part, or if the administration really folds all of the Bush tax cuts, you'll have a $3.6 trillion tax increase. So Democrats could let the spending trigger go off, get a series of spending cuts that are probably more tilted towards their priorities and what they would get out of the commission anyway. And then they could let the tax trigger go off and get vastly more in revenues than they could have ever have thought of getting through a deal. There are a lot of reasons to not want either of those outcomes, but the reasons to not want them rely on sort of theoretical worlds in which
right.
we get good deals. And if we don't see those, then I could certainly imagine Democrats preferring those outcomes.
Now, just to clarify, if the triggers go off, you said these cuts are not backloaded. They start in 2013.
They begin in 2013.
Right at the time that, theoretically, the Bush tax cuts would expire as well.
Exactly. So, I mean, you'd be looking in 2013 at a cut of spending around $110 billion, if I remember this correctly. I did the math on this the other night. $110 billion and then an immediate huge tax increase that year, too. That would be a really big hit to the economy in 1 year. And it's 2013 is not going to be a pretty economic year, even if the recovery does pick up a little bit of speed. So, I mean, there's a lot of reason to fear that. On the other hand, there's a lot of reason to fear bad deals. There's a lot of reason to fear starving the government of revenue going forward. I mean, there's a lot of reason to fear a lot of the possibilities out on the table. So, you know, a lot of this is just going to come down to what the negotiators are willing to agree to and then what the House is willing to agree to.
One more question on this tax issue is that my understanding is that the baseline now, we presume, the CBO presumes the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, so that in the event that any tax revenue came out of this deal, the Bush tax cuts are sort of off the table. They're not calculated into this. So any real revenue would have to come, have to exceed the amount of the expiration of the Bush tax cuts. Is that correct?
That is their theory. It's not quite correct. So what Boehner is spinning his members in a weird way. He's saying that this makes it impossible to raise taxes, and it doesn't. What it makes it very difficult to do is raise rates, because if you're raising rates, you're going to raise them by less than the Bush tax cuts would raise them, and as such, it would be counted as a tax cut, which would increase the deficit. But you could do all sorts of things that raise taxes and get scored as cutting the deficit by the Congressional Budget Office. So any loopholes you cut, any expenditures you cap, you know, just they're not going to do this. But as an example, they could cut the mortgage interest tax deduction. That would raise taxes and it would reduce the deficit, and CBO would have no problem with that. They could add a value-added tax. They could add a tax on carbon or cap and trade. They could do all sorts of things that would raise taxes. Now, the reason the taxes aren't going to go up is that Boehner and his people won't let them. But this sort of game he's playing here, where he's pretending there's a rule in place where taxes can never go up, is just not true.
And finally, and I'll let you go here. Now, this is going to do you have any sense this is going to pass today? This is going to be ratified by both houses today? Is that the plan anyways?
I think the plan is that it'll be ratified by – I mean, it's going to have a very easy ride in the Senate. There's no doubt about that. The House, people seem to expect it will pass. I mean, there's always a chance of some sort of TARP-like thing happening where it fails unexpectedly. But right now, I think people feel pretty good about its chances for passage.
Do you think that there could have been anything done in the past couple of weeks? I mean, put aside the notion of dealing with this debt ceiling during the tax deal.
Uh-huh.
Do you think there could have been anything done in the past couple of weeks to have mitigated the size of these cuts? I mean, and short of the idea of President Obama unilaterally talking about the trillion-dollar coin or the 14th Amendment?
Not really. I mean, I think also we have to keep in mind these cuts are smaller than pretty much any cuts that have been on the table at any other point in these negotiations. So I think what did happen is that Republicans couldn't agree to a deal, and as such, they, in many ways, I think, got a worse deal than they could have extracted out of the Obama administration, right? One concession the Obama administration was interested in having was that Republicans would let them be sort of the deal makers and, you know, show they were independent from the left and sort of bring people together in a postpartisan way. And because the Obama administration wanted that for reelection, they're willing to offer Republicans a really good deal for that. I mean, raising the Medicare eligibility age, cutting Social Security benefits, all sorts of things Republicans going to have a ton of trouble getting in any sort of normal time. Republicans said no. They weren't willing to allow essentially Obama to get any sort of like a pittance in revenues and also to sort of look like the big deal maker. So he didn't get that deal. I think the outcome of that is a better deal for people who, you know, believe that we shouldn't starve the government of revenue going forward, who believe that, you know, we probably shouldn't raise the Medicare eligibility age. But so if anything, I think it was very likely if this had ended 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago with a more of a compromise that you would have a deal with much larger cuts and maybe much deeper ones that folks like you would be more upset about than the
right.
deal we actually have on the table here, which is, as I said at the beginning, something of the lowest common denominator for both sides.
And that $1 trillion that was in the Reid plan, to assuming getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan, and the $400 billion that was assuming savings on interest, Does that figure into any of this, or is that just simply a completely different frame?
Yeah, that'll all happen in the background one way or the other. I mean, interest happens no matter what, and that war drawdown is something we're already doing. And the question is simply if you're going to ask CBO to count it or not before it happens. So that'll happen one way or the other.
All right, Ezra Klein, thank you so much. I appreciate you doing this and explaining this, the machinations for us. As always, very helpful.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. All right, we got to take a break, folks. Excuse me. We got to take a break. We will be right back with the Majority Report after this. That's the deal. That's the Satan sandwich. It was either the Satan sandwich or Beelzebub's tart that was on the menu. Or that devil's quiche. Oh, if only I was more of a wordsmith. Give me a minute and I'll be right back. I'll come up with a couple more. We'll be right back. All right, folks, we are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Folks, let me do a little house cleaning here. I sort of dropped the bomb in that Mila broke her wrist. I'll talk more about that in the membership post-show. Just horrible. And I'll talk more about the Apple. What I'm trying to do these days, folks, so that you understand, is try and take negative things and balance them out with good things. And there is a lot riding on this new Apple that I found. Let me tell you. Sort of, it mixes well with that Satan sandwich, and not Satan sandwich. Folks, our tech guru, of course I'm speaking of Kyle, has developed an update to donate your account. You can now donate your account on Facebook. If I have ever asked anything of you before, I am doing it again. Put it that way. If you go to donateyouraccount.com, if you haven't already donated your Twitter account, and I'll tell you something, I do not think, Matt, will you confirm this for me? Have we ever had anybody cancel their donateyouraccount.com on Twitter by finding like, ugh, I don't like what they're putting out, or this is too much, or anything? Has anybody had any regret? I've never gotten an email to that effect.
I don't believe so. I mean, the numbers just keep going up. I've never seen them go down.
There you have it, folks. After 6 months of doing this, not one cancellation on Twitter, because people are happy. They're happy to have this automatically retweeted once a day. Or you can choose once a week or once a month. We do the big, big, big ones on once a month. And now you can do this on your wall on Facebook. Facebook is much stickier. If you ever said to yourself, hey, it would be nice if there were 10,000, 20,000, 50,000, 100,000 more people listening to what I listen to every day, you can help in that process. Go to donateyouraccount.com. You can sign in with Facebook and donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. Or you can simply find our campaign, Majority FM. A lot of people are doing this. We have a lot of competition now. But Kyle, let us in on this first. So, folks, don't embarrass me in front of Kyle, for God's sakes. It would be embarrassing. So you've heard Ezra Klein break it down. Remember, now, Ezra is a left-leaning policy wonk. And so he looks at this strictly from a policy perspective. Occasionally, he will add in some political aspects of it, but more in terms of how the policy is concocted. You'll notice that in the conversation, the idea... And though he prefaced it with, this is bad policy, it starts off with the premise that this is bad policy. Because, like I read in that first piece up front, The idea that you are not spending, that you are in any way taking money out of the economy, is bad policy at this time. Even if it's raising of taxes. Now, from my perspective, you raise taxes essentially so that you can spend more. And we don't need to raise taxes to spend more. We have unlimited borrowing capacity until interest rates start having to go through the roof. Interest rates are at an all-time low. It is criminal for us not to be borrowing money at this rate. Criminal. We are not a family. Look up the etymology of tighten your belt. Can you do that, Matt, for me? We can talk about more of this. But the idea of tightening your belt is because you're not eating enough. And you're getting skinnier. So you need to tighten your belt. That's what families, the idea that families are tightening their belt. There is an obligation by government when families have to tighten their belt to actually spend more because they can. Because they can borrow money. Corporations, they borrow money. Now, they're not borrowing a ton of money right now because they have so much cash on hand. But when you want to expand something, you borrow money. Farmers do that. Business people do that. Is it a good idea for families? No, because the debt can be so crushing, because you're looking at 15, 20, 25%, 30% interest rates on credit cards. And because you don't know if you have a way of making money in the future. We do know that we have a way of making money in the future. We know that there is a tax base. And we also know, by the most basic of economics, that if government spends money, it will grow the GDP. If it grows the GDP, it will necessarily bring in more tax revenue. And so we should be spending money now. And so one of the downsides, you know, everything that Ezra was talking about that may be a so-called positive or a silver lining in this deal is all really what he's talking is there are mitigating factors that don't make this a Satan shit sandwich. It's just a Satan sandwich. It's not actually the Satan feces sandwich that it could be. Those are just mitigating factors. And he touched on the idea that President Obama has signed on to this supply side don't turn off my 360. Always keep it on.
I think I pinned something down earlier. Sorry about that.
Yeah. I will turn it off. I would rather turn it off if we need to pin it on. This confidence fairy. This idea that if we cut and show that we're responsible, what's going to happen? Are businesses more likely to see consumers spend more money? Of course not. Consumers don't base money on the deficit and they're spending on the deficit. Are you kidding me? Consumers spend money based on the fact that they either feel secure in their jobs or they have a job. They don't say, hey, I may be getting this promotion, 20 grand a year, 10 grand a year, 5 grand a year, but if taxes go up another 2% on me after a certain amount, you know, I'm only going to be making 95% of that raise. You know, that extra $2,000 a year, that extra $5,000, that extra $10,000, meh. I'm just going to see $8,500, $9,500 of it. $1,700, $1,800, $1,900 of it. It's ridiculous. This is the age we live in, and this is the problem with what President Obama did in this situation. Once he agreed to the terms of the Republican debate, there was no way for him to get a better deal. That I would agree with. He could have unilaterally moved on the 14th Amendment. He could have never agreed to the terms of the debate. He could have never put Medicare and Social Security on the table. But he's looking to win in 2012. And this is the way he's going to do it. It's the most important thing to him. Because if it wasn't, we would hear about jobs. That's the argument he would have made. And again, we still have the Supreme Court, the last vestige. And frankly, the most important thing right now for you as an activist, for you as a bystander to either agitate towards or simply pray for or hope for, or if you just want to know how this is going to go, watch who gets appointed to this commission, to this super Congress. Six Democrats. There needs to be a majority, right? I think it is 7-6. Watch who gets appointed to it. Is it going to be someone like Mark Warner, who is part of that group of six, who is willing to cut Social Security? Is it going to be Durbin who's willing to cut Social Security? What happens? I think Harry Reid, I'm not exactly sure if we know 100% how they get appointed, but I guess the leaders get to pick, and I don't know if they get to put two on each, if it's like, or three each. Reid gets three, Pelosi gets three. Watch for this. This is important. That's the most important thing. I think, personally, we would be better off if the trigger goes into effect. I don't see how they're going to get to $1.2 trillion in cuts and not cutting more from defense, or even 200, you know, or half the amount that they're, that the trigger would cause in the cutting of defense without cuts to Social Security and Medicare. And understand, when they make cuts to Social Security, understand what they're doing. They're not going to be cutting. They're not going to be taking money that comes into the general fund and just savings on Social Security. What they're going to do is not repay back the money that the U.S. government borrowed from Social Security to pay off the Bush tax cuts. That's what they're doing. When they cut Social Security, that's what they're doing. When they raise the retirement age for Medicare, all they're doing is that they're cutting the amount of outlays that they're going to need. And for you 65-year-olds, or soon-to-be 65-year-olds like me, not that soon, but you're shit out of luck. That's what we're looking at. So watch that committee. That's going to be the most important thing. And pray that the trigger is in effect. It's going to be interesting to watch those guys like Lieberman and Graham. How they deal with the idea of raising taxes. Just quickly, Brian Beutler. Silver linings. It's backloaded. So the cuts that they announced up front anyways won't come really in a significant way over the past next year or so, which is what Ezra Klein said. The enforcement, this dynamic on the super committee, as we just mentioned. The Bush tax cuts are the expiration of which, as of now, are still in effect. And they're supposed to rise in starting 2013. So theoretically, the rich will be paying their whole share. We'll see. And we will update as the year goes on. And there is no default. So Wall Street's happy. The problems, domestic discretionary cuts. It's not a part of the budget that's grown particularly fast, so your food's going to be a little more tainted. Your air is going to be a little more smoky because you're not going to have enforcement. Your education, your kids are going to be a little stupider. It goes on and on. Everything the government does, basically, will be scaled back. The lack of the unemployment insurance and payroll cut, anti-stimulative, as Ezra said, that will be included in some deal in the budget, the 2012 budget. Yeah, the other thing is that no one's mentioning is that from a political standpoint, Obama has made it absolutely clear, you can roll me. And I will even fuck over Reid and Pelosi to do it. McConnell met with Obama before Obama met with Reid when Reid's bill failed in the Senate. Understand that. Obama made a deal with McConnell and then called Reid and Pelosi in and said, you got to take this deal. And it's Democrats in the House and the Senate are in a very difficult place. Because Obama remains popular within the Democratic Party. He is a source of fundraising. How do you run against a Democratic president when they are popular if you are a Democrat? It's extremely difficult. I don't know what Democrats are going to run against. I think they're hoping that Republicans are going to want to cut Medicare and Social Security. Maybe we will see out of this super Congress. Remember, anything comes out of this 12-person super Congress, there's no filibuster. Yes, it is possible, Virginia. You can have a bill pass in the Senate without a filibuster if that's what your Gallatin overlords want. Needs a simple majority, no amendments. So what the Democrats could be thinking is, one turncoat Democrat signs off on the super Congress's Social Security Medicare cutting bill. Most Democrats vote against it. It goes into effect and they try and run on that. But the problem is, how do you run on that? How do you run on that when your president has signed off on this? I don't know. We shall see. The political cost here is enormous. And in fact, Paul Krugman today, this victory for bipartisan compromise for the economy and for the American. What did it originally say, Matt? Didn't you pull the original title?
Yes, one second.
This is the press release released by the Obama administration, which I tweeted out and had literally like 1,000 people click through to the link, which was one of my highest sort of yields ever. And then they, what did they do?
The original title is Fact Sheet, a victory for bipartisan compromise for the economy and for the American people. And the one they changed it to is Fact Sheet, bipartisan debt deal, a win for the economy and budget discipline.
Now, in both cases, it's a complete lie. It's not a win for the economy. It's a loss for the economy. A victory for bipartisan compromise. I literally laughed. I got that. You know, I'm on these email lists, and I got it sent to my email box. And I opened it up, and I literally laughed. Literally laughed, and then I just started to cry. Folks, we're going to head to the post show, and I will talk more about this. Just more house cleaning. Tomorrow will be a pre-tape. I'm going to include two things. One is an interview I did on Friday with a guy about their Save Our Schools protest this weekend, what they were protesting, what it was about. Another one, I think, with this guy Lanazin. I can't remember his name. Who, it's a little bit dry, but it's fascinating. Look, this guy knows exactly what he's talking about on how stock options have fundamentally destroyed our economy in terms of compensation for CEOs. because it has provided the absolute wrong incentive for CEOs, and they have turned their corporations from entities that job number one was production of services and goods for profit into job number one, this is a financial instrument that is going to make profits for me vis-a-vis shareholders. Those are two subtly different things. It is a fascinating interview. I'm not sure about Wednesday. I may or may not do a pre-tape. I'll be traveling tomorrow. I may try and do something live as well on the airplane if I can do it. I'm going to be on an airplane. I'm going to see if I can try. If I can do it, I'll just do it. We'll have more on this debt ceiling, and I'm going to try and track down somebody. There's a fascinating thing happening in Israel right now. There are massive anti, I don't know if I would call it capitalist, but anti-free market, anti, I don't know how really to characterize this. Anti-privatization rallies, massive. Hundreds of thousands of Israelis across the country, tent cities, whatnot, the equivalent marches over the past day or two, equivalent to 6 million people marching in this country. It is oddly part of the Arab Spring. And I don't know that it impacts their perspective on the validity of the second-class citizens that are in their country, but it's fascinating. I'm going to try and talk to someone about that, and I will definitely cover that over the next couple of days. I'll try and provide some news for tomorrow if I can find some time to record it. Meet me on the flip side, Majority FM. The number is 646-257-3920. We'll see you then.